music, I did not forget you. The music is being piled up and everything. I'm trying to make stuff right. Because as you can tell, oh, 3 seconds. I'll see you. All right, babes. I love you. Mwah, bye.
A mess.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. On today's show, we had the chance to speak with the founder of PLR, otherwise known as the Project Love Run. Project Love Run offers and facilitates a monthly run to brunch for women. It encourages women to run and then share stories and advice, listen and learn from each other. Project Run Love was built with the intention to create safe space, meaningful conversations, and genuine connections for women. Here to tell us more about the project and its impact is the founder, Felsen.
My name is Felsen Abdiaman, and I am an ultra runner. I am a coach and a personal trainer, and I'm also the founder of Project Love Run. Project Love Run is a women's only running collective, and its aim is to offer self-identifying women a safe space to talk about matters of the heart. So it's a monthly run to brunch. That's the way it's structured. It gets women coming outside to run together and then have heart-to-heart conversations that just allow them to be more their authentic selves and also to connect and listen to each other and learn from each other's personal stories. So the whole goal is to make women aware of their self-worth and to know that they're loved. So that's the message that I try and bring to all the women, just reminding them that they're loved and the most important relationship that they have is with themselves. I've been hosting these runs since 2016. It started out in Toronto, where I first lived. I was there for 13 years until I moved out west to Vancouver, BC. But I started the runs out in Toronto with a couple of friends of mine. What we did was we ran on Halloween in October 2016. And we were dressed up in wedding dresses, and I came up with the idea of the runaway bride theme, and I used that to symbolize women running towards something much more greater, which is that self-love. The idea was to encourage women to get rid of all the negativity associated with modern day romance and reclaim control over matters of their heart. So just to give you a bit more context, at that time I was single and I was feeling very lost and dissatisfied with online dating, and I did a lot of online dating, and it was very disheartening to put yourself out there and seemingly do everything right and then, you know, easily be swiped away or go on a date that you had hoped went well but didn't. And, you know, it just, that feeling of rejection made me realize that I should stop looking for love outside externally and just look inward. And that's where I really began the work of self-love with that kickstart run. So we ran through downtown Toronto in our wedding dresses and got a lot of attention because people thought we were the runway brides. But we celebrated afterwards with dinner and drinks at a local bar. And we just chatted about, you know, loving ourselves and what that means, what that looks like, and just celebrating our self-love, basically. Mm-hmm. And then ever since that run, I started these monthly runs in Toronto, and it was just like maybe 2-3 friends that would show up to these runs. And there was always a theme that we would have that, again, focuses on self-love and just women's issues, difficult subjects that don't really get discussed. My goal was to shine a light on these subjects so that it's more comfortable to talk about them and to destigmatize them. I myself have struggled with sharing personal stories with loved ones, my family. I had a really hard time coming out to them and telling them that I was suffering from an eating disorder. My journey with running and this community that I've grown gave me that confidence to open up to them and let them know that this is what I've been struggling with, my mental health, depression, anxiety, and an eating disorder. And that release and freedom you feel afterwards, after sharing these truths about yourself with those that matter most to you, it just changes your perspective on a lot of things in life. And it made me realize that they were very supportive, and it just proved to me to continue to do this and to continue to show women that they should be confident in owning their truth and being authentic. And so that is what we do. We just run to brunch and have these discussions. And it's in Montreal now. The launch of the Montreal Project Love Run was this past weekend. It's in Vancouver. I launched it out here in 2018, and in 2019 it was launched in Calgary and Edmonton.
That's so exciting.
Thank you.
So you mentioned running. Running helped you find self-love, and also helped the people who joined the group as well. What do you think it is about running in particular that facilitates that?
I believe that when you're running, everything gets put in perspective, and being out there, it can be a team sport, like you're running with others, but there are times that you go out on runs and you're alone, and you're alone with your thoughts, and that forces you to process what's happening in your mind as you run. And a lot of the times, it puts things in perspective for you to see that sometimes these are barriers that you create for yourself that can easily be overcome with skills or just being yourself in I don't know. It's interesting, right? You just start to see, like, for example, I'll give you my own experience as an example. I do a lot of ultra trail running, and a lot of the times when I'm out there on the trails, it's just me, and the next runner is maybe 2 hours up ahead of me, and the one behind me is probably another hour behind me. So in whatever race that I do, these trail races, there are times where I'm alone in the middle of these huge forests, and I'm just there with my thoughts. So I'm forced to confront whatever demons I have to get me through the race. And that process of just confronting what you fear, or, you know, these struggles that you face is a way of growing and moving past them. So, yeah, with a lot of the run-to brunches that I facilitate out here west, whatever topic we discuss, I like to use my story as an example to allow the women to see how I've managed to use running to help me process a lot of things that have happened in my life. And then that allows them to see how it can help them and just share how they've been able to move through running to overcome certain struggles in their personal life.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned, so the runs are followed by like a brunch or an opportunity to get together and to talk about topics around self-love. How do you decide the topics, and has there been any particular conversations that have really stood out or impacted you?
So the brunch aspect of this group is really important because, like I said, my experience with an eating disorder and my relationship with food in the past was never really that great. And I always had these like internal messaging or negative self-talk that would make me feel like eating a certain way was good and eating another way was bad. So I wanted to emphasize the aspect of eating as much as the running, because it's important to eat with intention and just like with the intention to love your body and fuel your body, and not for it to look a certain way or perform a certain way. So I try and emphasize that in the discussions, in the brunch spots and restaurants that we pick. And the topics too that we pick always tie on these themes of, like, you know, body love. And like our last run this past weekend, for example, was touched on the subject of celebrating our bodies and trying to notice the subtle messages of diet culture and fat phobia, and how that affects your internalized messaging to yourself. So I think I lost my chain of thought in the question. Did I answer your question?
You did. I snuck in like two questions in one. So the second part of the question was have you had any discussions in these runs that have particularly impacted you?
Yes. So going back to that subject of diet culture, this past week was the theme that I picked was really important to me, because I've struggled with body dysmorphia and like, you know, just eating disorder and that internalized fat phobia that I had. And so trying to shine a light on that was my way of healing, and also showing women that sometimes, you know, they have to be aware of these subtle messaging in society that makes them feel unloved. So I really enjoyed seeing women tag us in their virtual runs, or just getting the other leaders sending me clips of the videos and discussions that they had when they gathered. Because just to give you a bit more context, the run in Montreal and the run in Calgary were outdoors, so women were able to meet up and have these discussions. But where the other runs were happening in the other cities, it was virtual, and then women would tag us with their thoughts on the subject. And it was really interesting to see that for a lot of women, they struggle to really love their bodies and have, I would say, a very complicated relationship with loving their bodies. So that's a theme I noticed in a lot of the commenting that came up with this run. And I think that's sad, but at the same time, I feel like being aware of that and working to respect your body and try and honor it for all that it does to you is important. And I try to put that out there with the messaging that and the content that I was putting out for this past weekend's run.
You mentioned that now it's in several cities. So how has that experience been expanding the project and making it national?
It happened very naturally and organically. My good friend in Toronto decided to keep the runs going there and become a leader and host the runs on my behalf. And then in Calgary, after in 2019, it was around International Women's Day, actually, 2019, Sport Check and Reebok Canada helped me launch Project Club Run out in Calgary. And then one of the women that was at the run was asking me a lot of questions when I was there and was like, I would really like to have these runs happening in this city. So she took my contact and we communicated back and forth. And then we ended up launching it, just testing it out with her friends. And then it just took off. A lot of women would come out to the runs in Calgary. I think the biggest group before COVID was 20 women coming out to those runs. And then Edmonton, my Calgary leader, her sister-in-law came out to one of her runs in Calgary. And then it's the message and everything about Project Club Run spoke to her, and she reached out to me, and we again went through a process of communicating back and forth. And she was like amazing. And so I was like, yeah, let's do this. So we started the runs out in Edmonton. And then this year in Montreal, one of the leaders, Marge, I don't know if you're familiar with her. She's a runner out in Montreal, and she and I would chat a lot on Instagram, and I saw she was big in the running community out in Montreal, and I was like, I think she would be great to lead the runs out in Montreal, and it just happened naturally again. Like around COVID, we had a video call, and then things aligned and it worked out for her. She had the time to dedicate to the runs in Montreal, and we made it happen. So I love that it's growing, and there is a natural need for these runs. Like women see the importance and value of having such a safe space. And, I always like to tell people that ask me about Project Club Run that it's not like a running group and out there, like the running groups in the running room. It's very different in the sense that it's not so much focused on performance, but focused on the relationship between the mind and the body and, just the individual. So you don't have to be a runner. You don't have to be a marathon runner. You can just come and the way it's structured, the runs, they're short to allow for all fitness levels to come out. And then there's always someone leading and someone at the back to ensure that the group stays together.
One of the things I noticed on the website is the kind of value section of creating safe spaces, genuine connections, meaningful conversations. And there's a resource page on your on the website that has so many great resources. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are about accessibility, anti-racism, diversity. Can you speak a bit to why that's important to center in this project?
Yeah, well, I think that not only with what's happening in the world, you know, the I don't know how to describe it, but the Black Lives Movement and the racial awakening in June, I think the way the wellness sector and the wellness space is created is it's I find not entirely inclusive, and that's because of access, and not everyone has access to the space or to the classes or feels like they belong in those certain spaces, and this is something that most people don't really realize, but I've noticed more and more, and more people are discussing this, that how the wellness space is not entirely inclusive. But I think it's important for those that occupy those wellness spaces realize that how their space is created to be exclusive. I feel with Project Love Run, I try and emphasize that it's a space for all, even with how I say it's a safe space for self-identified women, trans women, like all self-identified women. It's a space for them to feel like they belong. And then also too, Black women, like I have on the education space, a section for like Black girl healing, or, you know, because I know that it's not easy for Black women to share their stories with women that are non-Black, like that. Based off my experience. So having a section dedicated to women the Black women, where they feel like they can share their stories and not feel judged, I think it's really important. And making these resources available to the community, I think is really important, because we don't realize the biases that we carry in our everyday lives. And I hope that just by reading some of the sources I have up on the site, which I try and update regularly, I think it's a good place to start for most people, because you don't realize it, but taking action and being an ally, it starts with you, and it starts with your thoughts. And this is the easiest way to do that work that requires the change that everyone's looking for. It's just starting with yourself and your internal biases. And I think it's very important. And it also guides the women in the discussions that we have when we have brunch. Actually, this question that you asked me is really important, I think, because I find as a Black woman, dealing with also some of my leaders that are, non-Black white women, that relationship, there's different privileges each one of us have. And, it's important for the women that lead these runs to be aware of those privileges. And I think it's really important for everyone to be having these discussions.
Moving forward, obviously there's already a lot of expansion right now with Project Love Run, but what do you hope for the future of this project?
I am really hoping that it takes off in other cities as well and grows nationwide, maybe one day even internationally. I think it's really important for women to realize, I'll say, the magic of self-love. And for me, running was the medium that allowed me to see that. And I just want to share that with other women and also offer a counter narrative than what sometimes is present in, I would say, our fitness world and fitness culture. You know, it's a counter narrative that shows by moving your body and running, you're not disciplining your body to reach a certain ideal. You're loving your body just the way it is, and you're expressing that through movement, which is running. I think it's really important for women to make that association with running, because a lot of the times running is seen as this, I don't know what it's seen as nowadays, but I want to change that perception of running and eating as well, you know, eating away from diet culture and eating by giving your body what she or they need and fueling your body with love.
And if people want to join or learn more, where can they go?
Any self-identifying woman looking to join a running group can look up Project Love Run. We've got a website online, and it's projectloverun.com. We post frequently on social media, Instagram in particular, but we do have a Facebook group, which is Project Love Run as well, and our Instagram is Project Love Run.
Great. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Keeping
You're listening to Dragon Root Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We're going to switch gears and present our interview with Dawn Canada. We had the chance to speak with Nelly from Dawn. Dawn is the Disabled Women's Network of Canada, and they recently released a report called Girls Without Barriers, an intersectional feminist analysis of girls and young women with disabilities in Canada. Here to talk more about Dawn and the report is Nelly.
My name is Nelly Basili, and I am I've been working with Dawn Canada for a little over 2.5 years now. I'm the Director of Youth Initiatives and International Relations. Dawn Canada, so the Disabled Women's Network of Canada, or Dawn for short, is a feminist and cross-disability rights organization. So we have been defending the rights of girls and young women with disabilities for 35 years now. And Dawn Canada is explicitly a feminist organization that works in the disability sector, but we also bridge the gaps between the disability sector that may not have a gender lens and the feminist sector that may not have a disability lens. And how we do that and what that means is we do that through education, we do that through research, we do that through, partnering with organizations and helping them with their programs. We do that through advocacy and policy at more, I guess, higher levels, at governmental levels, but also advocacy with other organizations in various sectors.
Now you touched on this a little bit, but what are Dawn's key principles, and what lens does Dawn examine inequalities and discrimination?
Yeah, sure. So obviously we have the prism of looking at things through an intersectional feminist lens. And what that means is that we want to center the most marginalized in all of the work that we do. Not only center the most marginalized, but also add a disability in it, specifically a cross-disability lens. So if we break that down from an intersectional feminist perspective, we really want to center those who are from, you know, communities that have been historically marginalized. So that means Black, Indigenous, and people of color. When we add the cross-disability lens, we also look at, disability from a wide spectrum. And that means any form of disability and not in a medicalized way. And giving people the agency, women the agency to self-identify and not requiring any formal diagnoses. And moving away from the medical model and medical systems that, you know, have often been very detrimental and traumatic for girls and young women with disabilities and for people in general with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell us about the Girls Without Barriers project?
Sure. So Girls Without Barriers as a project is... has been running for a few years now, and the aim of Girls Without Barriers really is to work with organizations that are what we call girl-serving organizations that run programs for girls and really help them in the process of making their programming for girls more inclusive and respectful of the realities of girls with disabilities. And what that means is we look at things from a structural level. We look at things from how ableism affects, you know, what kind of programming, what kind of services are offered. And what we find is that if we look at it from a structural level, we work with organizations to also look at, you know, who is on their boards, who is on their staff. Do they, understand how ableism works within those structures as well, so that they are then better able to do their programming with girls with disabilities. So we really want to look at things from root causes, from structural levels, in order to help the programming be better and more inclusive for girls with disabilities. And we've been working with different organizations. For example, we've worked with Rock Camp for Girls. Mm-hmm. We've also worked with Black Girls Summer Workshop, which are both camps for girls in the summertime, and they run programs for girls, and they're really wonderful programs and partners, because they really want to look at things from an intersectional feminist lens. They really want to look at things from a disability lens and better understand how they can, you know, get at things like ableism and explain it to kids, and be more inclusive of the different needs of girls with disabilities who may want to be part of their programs. And we really encourage them to do all of these things, you know, by helping them from recruitment to all the way to programming that they do. And within that, Girls Without Barriers, we also have a research component. And this is where our research report, you know, Girls Without Barriers, an intersectional feminist lens, you know, that looks at the situation of girls and young women with disabilities in Canada, also comes about.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit more about this, the research component, and if or what or some challenges that you encountered while conducting the study?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Girls Without Barriers, as a research project, the research component of this project came about because, you know, we actually a year ago released a report, another report called More Than a Footnote. And in that report, we already, you know, had the data that confirmed that women with disabilities are among the most marginalized in Canadian society. And what that means is they, you know, face multiple societal barriers to accessing things like education, employment, health, reproductive rights, and are also more at risk of experiencing things like gender-based violence. But what that research also showed is the lack of data about girls with disabilities. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Girls Without Barriers is really, as a research project, is really a first step in starting to bridge that gap. So over the course of this research, we found it difficult to access Canadian statistics about girls with disabilities. So, you know, Girls Without Barriers, as a research report, really set out to not only review literature that already exists in the form of, you know, academic articles and community/activist-based reports on the rights of girls and young women with disabilities, but it also intentionally set out to better understand the realities of girls with disabilities, who not only have to deal with ableism as a system, but also racism, colonialism, sexism, heterosexism, and other systems of oppression, and how they intersect and affect their lives. You know, I also want to clarify that this report, you know, is a first step. It's not an exhaustive analytical work. We consider this report as a first exploratory research project that really did look at the existing literature as a first step towards the development of, you know, more qualitative studies carried out by and for young women with disabilities. We really, there is a dearth of information that directly talks from the perspective of girls with disabilities. So another thing that we mention and highlight in this report is we really need to move away from this adult perspective on girls. This adult perspective over time, it reinforces this infantilization of girls, and we're really trying to move away from that. And so, you know, we strongly urge everyone to listen to girls, to listen to their perspectives. Girls with disabilities have so much to bring about, and yet their perspectives are not sufficiently put out there without that lens, you know, that is an adult lens, because even the research that we looked at is from an adult perspective. The starting points are always from the adult perspective. So we're really trying to bring that to the fore and move away from that.
Hmm. In the report, you also take time to examine the increasing incarceration of girls and young women with disabilities. And you also emphasize that incarceration isn't limited to the imprisonment of people following court decisions. Can you talk to us a little bit more about how the erasure of this issue?
Sure. So maybe to start with, I can talk about what we mean by sort of our definition of incarceration, if you will. Mm-hmm. We, you know, as we are in an ableist society, disability is intrinsically linked with incarceration. And within, you know, the analyses that we work with at Dawn, we consider that incarceration is not limited to imprisonment of people following court decisions only, you know, so we broaden that definition of incarceration to include things like placement of people, consenting or not, or otherwise, into institutions that really limit their human rights, that limit their living conditions and their dignity. You know, we have to remember that historically, Western societies included people, excluded, people with disabilities from the public sphere by limiting their access and, you know, or placing them in institutions. And so it is from that perspective that we look at incarceration. But more specifically, you know, we live also in a racist and colonialist society, and incarceration, in this case, via court decision, has a singular impact on racialized women, on Indigenous women. So just to clarify what we mean by that. Now, the way we looked at incarceration as well is how does it affect, for example, children when we talk about things like, and girls specifically, when we talk about things like school to prison pipelines, and how girls with disabilities who are racialized, so, you know, coming from racialized communities, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, are more affected by this, especially racialized girls with disabilities. The other thing that we looked at is how incarceration linked with migratory status affects girls with disabilities. And what we found is that the rate of, there was a report by the Canadian Council for Refugees that found in 2018-2019 that 118 children were detained in immigration detention. And the findings with that all indicate that the conditions of incarceration really are detrimental to the development of children. You know, they affect their mental health, they affect things like increasing anxiety and depression in children who have been through these detention conditions. And so it goes against human rights and protocols internationally that Canada has signed on to.
Were there any surprises that came up in the study, or was there, or I guess, and is there anything in the study that you feel everyone should know or take away?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that what we focalize on is, again, the lack of data that is available on girls with disabilities. The statistical data that is compiled does not look at the intersections of race and gender for girls with disabilities. And that is a huge lack that needs to be gapped. And that means, you know, having things like governments at the, you know, Canadian government at the federal level do a better job of collecting these kinds of data because they're important. Not collecting this data further invisibilizes girls and young women with disabilities. As it pertains to, you know, findings in the report that I think are really important to note, we note that girls and young women with disabilities face obstacles in accessing inclusive and empowering sex education. Given the various data that we've collected in the report, we also know that girls and young women with disabilities facing different systems of oppression are at higher risk of having their reproductive rights hampered and of being sterilized without consent. The literature also specifically addressing two-spirit, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, intersex, asexual, aromantic, pansexual, and more young people with disabilities, you know, calls out, among other things, the imposition of gender norms and sexual identities. So that means, that gender and sexual and physical norms imposed by an ableist society also have major consequences on the self-esteem of girls and young women with disabilities. And when we talk about, you know, things like body image, the research shows that the negative effects of beauty standards that are set, again, by an ableist and sexist society. The participation of girls and young women with disabilities in things like leisure and sports activities have significant positive impacts on their self-esteem. But the report shows that despite the importance of their participation in these activities, girls and young women with disabilities, you know, still remain underrepresented. Accessibility is still a major barrier. And, from our collaborations to make programs for girls more inclusive, what I talked about earlier with the Girls Without Barriers project, shows us that there's a tremendous amount of work that still remains to be done in creating more awareness about ableism and how it functions in order to better serve, you know, the needs of girls and young women with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that work that needs to be done, the report has recommendations and calls for action. Can you speak a bit to that?
Yeah, sure. So, the report, we have recommendations for government, for advocacy groups and for human rights organizations in Canada to, you know, take action to ensure, you know, that girls are again, at the center of our concerns, especially when it comes to disability. So we have a lot of recommendations, but just to name a few. So for governments, you know, we want government to collect data on girls in Canada using an intersectional feminist and cross-disability analysis and make that data publicly available. We want government to consult girls with disabilities and guarantee their self-representation in decision-making spheres and in research, which they are, you know, the first concern. When it comes to education, we want government to make teaching establishments universally accessible. It is unacceptable that in Canada in 2020, there are still inaccessible establishments for education that limit the education of girls with disabilities. We also are asking for the development of national awareness and training programs for teachers and students to educate them about the various systems of oppression that I've mentioned, including, you know, a better understanding of what ableism means. When it comes to, sexuality and gender identity, we want governments to develop and standardize positive, inclusive, emancipatory sex education in Canada that really moves away from, you know, the adult perspective I mentioned earlier in order to center the experiences and realities of girls and young women with disabilities. And that goes hand in hand with, you know, to subsidize the development of educational materials for parents, for health and school professionals, on the sexuality and reproductive rights of girls and young women with disabilities, and the list goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what impact do you hope that this report has more broadly?
Well, we really would love that people better understand the realities of girls with disabilities who are most marginalized. We deliberately took an intersectional feminist lens in talking about this report. So we want people to have better knowledge of this report, read it, and understand that when we talk about girls with disabilities, they're not a homogenous group. Mm-hmm. Girls with disabilities, come with a complexity of identities and of systems of oppression that affect them. So when we did this report, we also illustrated the report, and we worked with an artist who is themselves a queer Black person with a disability to embody, what it means to have representation of girls with disabilities. The images we see in our report are not images that we see in mainstream media. And that needs to change, because in order to affect, all these things like self-esteem and that girls with disabilities feel like they matter and are empowered, they need to see themselves represented in those images that we see in the media. So we want to start to change the culture and shift, those ableist ideas of who young women with disabilities and girls with disabilities are, but also have them at the center of the decisions that will affect their lives.
Nelly, thanks so much for your articulate and enlightening answers. If people want to learn more or get involved, where can they go?
Sure. So in order to read our report, you will find it on the Dawn Canada website, and that's at www.dawncanada.net. I also encourage folks to go and follow us on social media. So if you go to Facebook, for example, and you type Disabled Women's Network, Réseau d'Action des Femmes Handicapées Canada, you will find us and you give us a like and keep following the information that we put out there as it pertains to girls and young women with disabilities.
Perfect. Thanks so much again for chatting with us today.
You're a silent forest, you're a wild flower, you've been moving backwards into the wildfire, but you're a sharpened arrow, spearing heart, stone cold, and you're a red-winged blackbird, perched up on the darkest of wars. He never gave you time or the space to soar, but you're a sharpened arrow that tried to spear a heart stone cold, and you're a red-winged blackbird perched up on the window.
You're listening to Dragonroot Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'd like to thank all our guests who came on the show today. And be sure to tune in 2 Mondays from now for more.
You know, it's the boy Dash all the way from Grenada, and you tune in to CQUT 90.3 FM.
Suoni Perilpopolo is back, and in real life for its 22nd edition. All the sights, sounds, and sensations of live music. After 2 years of online adaptation, Suoni is filling up the month of June with liberated music of all genres. Over 45 events and 90 participating artists performing indoors, outdoors, streamed for maximum accessibility. Record and book launches, workshops, a puppet show, a satellite Suoni happening in Wakefield, Quebec, of all places, and, of course, much more. For all the goodies, check out suoniperilpopolo.org. Masks will, of course, be required. For your audio program guide, tune in to the Montreal Sessions, Tuesday, May 24th, May 31st, and June 7th and 14th, from 3 till 5 p.m. The Suoni crew hosts will be serving up highlights of what to expect at this year's festival. This is, of course, a CKUT co-presentation.